Good evening to you. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Health Matters. I'm your host, Kermit Poling, and on tonight's discussion, we'll be talking about HIV. Currently, 1.1 million people in the United States live with HIV. And since AIDS was first diagnosed in the United States in the early 80s, there have been many advances in diagnosing and treating HIV. I have the pleasure of being joined in the studio today by infectious disease physician Dr. Gerardo Negron. Also, Brett Malone, who's the executive director of the Philadelphia Center in Shreveport, along with another special guest who is familiar to our audiences here. That's Bobby Darrow, who, of course, is the artistic director of Shreveport Little Theater and has also lived with HIV since 1985. That's 28 years, and he'll be talking about living with HIV. So we have a lot of great topic matter to cover tonight. Your phone calls are welcome as well for any of our guests. Here's the number, 800-552-8502. That is 1-800-552-8502. You can be on the air live with us, or if you want to remain anonymous, that's fine. We can also transcript your questions into the studio if you prefer to do that. But again, our number, 800-552-8502. Dr. Negron, let's start with you, and why don't you talk a little bit about what HIV is and what are the early symptoms of being infected?
Now, HIV itself is what they call a retrovirus. It's a particular type of virus. Prior to 1980, there were two that were known in the world that were associated, one of which was associated with cancer. And then right around 1980, 1981, we had a new one appear that was subsequently identified a few years after that, and it was named human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. It's the virus that causes AIDS. Mm-hmm. Now, once a person gets infected, and sexual contact is the most common way in this day and age, a person can have no symptoms whatsoever at the time of infection, or they can have cold and flu symptoms, or they can have what they call retroviral syndrome, which might be like a severe cold and flu symptoms, maybe with symptoms of meningitis, and it can be anywhere in that continuum. So it's not uncommon that a person, when first infected, may not even notice it.
Bobby, if you don't mind me asking you, because, of course, this is 28 years ago, but what was the situation like when you first realized that you had HIV?
I was diagnosed first with having HTLV-3.
Okay, which is?
It was a precursor to HIV.
Okay.
HIV had not been developed yet, or that term.
Hadn't come up with yet.
Right. And and it was just very different. There were no drugs available. When we heard about AZT, we just hoped we could get our hands on it. We were guinea pigs for many medicines that came down through the pipeline. Some of them almost killed us. But eventually, they have come up with some wonderful drugs. Not only one class of drugs, but I think there's, five different classes of drugs. And so we combine them. We call it a cocktail and go on our way.
How long did it take to develop a true test for HIV?
Oh, based upon blood bank system, they actually were using surrogate testing by about 1987.
Uh-huh.
They were using people who had what was known to be hepatitis B at the time, because the viruses tended to travel together. Shortly thereafter, by the late 80s, they actually had the first generation of an HIV test. Testing is done in two parts, as a screening test and then a confirmatory test. And these have been refined over the years.
Right. And have additional tests been included? What's been part of the revision, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, the HIV test, or screening antibody test, is the technology for it has improved over the years. And likewise, the confirmatory test, which is typically something called a HIV Western blot, has been refined. So doing the screening test and then the confirmatory test, if the screen is positive, has been the standard way, but the tests have gotten better. The reagents have improved. It's been less labor intensive to get the test done.
I remember years past, one of the fears that a lot of people had were getting blood transfusions. If they needed blood for something, that there were concerns about the blood supply being contaminated. Is that still an issue anymore?
Well, in the 80s, it was definitely still an issue. Mm-hmm. But you also had people who routinely would donate blood for money to many blood banks across the country. At this time, it is extremely uncommon. It's not zero, but you might have one in several hundred thousand cases of blood product transfusions where HIV could be transmitted. So it's extremely uncommon.
Okay.
Prior to the late 80s, as we found out, it was not uncommon to get it through transfusions. In particular, hemophiliac or patients, people with bleeding disorders, we basically lost an entire generation of young men who were dependent at that time on human-donated blood products to survive.
Mm-hmm.
As they became hepatitis infected, they became HIV infected, many did not survive.
Right. The number to call if you have a question this evening for our guests, Dr. Gerardo Negron, who's an infectious disease physician, Brett Malone, who's the executive director of the Philadelphia Center, and Bobby Darrow, who has lived with HIV for nearly 30 years. Call this number, 800-552-8502, and you can participate in this evening's Health Matters. So in this day and age, who is most at risk for contracting HIV?
I think I can speak to this one because we do at the Philadelphia Center a lot of outreach and recruitment for people to come in for testing as well as to really kind of learn what their risk factors are behaviorally. Statistically, one of the largest jumps is with the younger population, especially young African-American men, typically men who have sex with men and between the ages of 13 and 24. The numbers are pretty high with that particular group. Right now, there definitely has been a shift in terms of the demographics locally as well as nationally. Like mm-hmm. now, the majority of the new HIV cases are popping up in the Deep South, which unfortunately has traditionally been one of the least funded regions of the U.S., to try to develop effective prevention interventions.
Mm-hmm.
So while the epidemic has changed over the last 30 years in terms of where it is spreading most rampantly now, things have not changed so much in terms of how the funding flows from the feds. But again, we're seeing young African-American men who have sex with men being highest at risk, at least in our community.
With that being the case, and again, if I can follow up with you, Brett, what resources does the Philadelphia Center provide? In fact, maybe you might want to just explain exactly what the Philadelphia Center is.
Sure.
For those who are especially outside the immediate region. But what resources mm-hmm. also do you offer to those who are living with HIV and how to help prevent HIV?
Bobby could actually speak to the history of the Philadelphia Center okay. really well, so I would like to kind of give him
Absolutely.
That opportunity because he was part of that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a grassroots, and he was there. So, Bobby?
Well, my doctor and I, Dr. Mark Spurlock, got together and founded the Philadelphia Center. Actually, he founded it. He needed someone with a business background, which I had, and said, here, please... build this, and we did, on the backs of many wonderful individuals who are no longer with us. And that year was 1990 that we started the center. And there was nothing here in Shreveport at the time for direct services for people living with AIDS. We had some prevention programs, but nothing for people who were infected. I'll turn it over to Brett.
Okay. So it was good to know that we have a 23-year history with our community, and it was an organization that started because there was a need and no one else was really doing anything about HIV or AIDS in our community. Over the years, we have grown and developed to try to adjust to the changing needs of our community. So some of the services and programs that we offer, we start off with just, you know, prevention and awareness. We have a team of people who are trained and they hit the streets quite a bit. They're on Facebook, they're on different social networking apps on your phones that you can get. And they're reaching out to people who may be highest at risk and engaging them in conversations about their risk factors and then talking to them about how easy it is to come in and get tested for HIV and then what to do about it if you test positive. Mm-hmm. And from there, we also link people up to social supports as well as medical supports. For many years now, we've been offering case management services, which help work with individuals on sort of removing their barriers to accessing good healthcare services and linking them up to doctors or to clinics that can help them medically. We also offer mental health counseling. We offer substance abuse counseling, support groups. We now have an advocate on our staff who actually pulls people together around different issues related to HIV and AIDS and mobilizes them to try to affect change in our community and in our state. One of the big pluses that we have going on here in the Shreveport area through the Philadelphia Center that is pretty unique in that there's nowhere else north of I-10 that has a permanent supportive housing program that's specific for people living with HIV or AIDS. And so we have the Mercy Center here in Shreveport. And it's right near downtown, and it's really an amazing place. It's three older homes that actually we're in the process now of restoring them and renovating them through a grant that we got through the city of Shreveport. So that's going to take about a 6-month time frame for us to get those homes, you know, refurbished to the way they were back in the 1880s when those homes were originally built. So we have a very unique housing program. We also do housing supports to people in the community that we serve because we know that housing equals healthcare in our business, that when a person has a stable living situation, that oftentimes takes a lot of the stress out of their life. It helps them to, you know, get involved in medical care, to get prescribed medications, to get the lab work they need done, and to live a healthier life. It's unfortunately, when you don't have a home, going to a doctor or taking your medications is not your top priority. Sure. So housing does equal healthcare in our business. And so we're there trying to keep people housed so that they can stay healthier. We offer medical transportation to make sure people can remove the barriers that they need to get to a doctor's office or to a counseling appointment. We have support groups. We have a really cool program that is going on in the Natchitoches area. We've opened a satellite office down there about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's a smaller version of what we do up here. At this point, we are in the process of developing two different clinic programs because we see the need that our community has, one being a wellness center that's really going to be geared more towards gay, bisexual, and transgender women. But gay and bisexual men, excuse me, and transgender women. And that's going to be the PC's Wellness Center. That will actually begin in September. And through that, we're going to be able to expand some of our testing as well as treatment. So we'll be testing for other STDs like syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia, because oftentimes they run in the same circles. You know, the viruses and the bacteria, they have the same or similar routes of transmission. And having syphilis, for example, can make someone even more vulnerable to contracting HIV due to the lesions or other vulnerabilities that illness can cause.
Right.
And we are also partnering up with the MLK Clinic, and we're going to be starting providing an HIV specialty care clinic that will be free care for people who are uninsured or have no other way of paying for their medical care. And that'll be starting up this fall as well.
Okay. We'll come back to that in just a moment or two. That last answer there that you've been listening to, primarily from Brett Malone, who is the executive director of the Philadelphia Center in Shreveport. Also my other guests, Bobby Darrow, and infectious disease physician, Dr. Gerardo Negron. And we have our first caller for the evening. I want to give you the number in case you have a question this evening. The number is 1-800-552-8502. You're welcome to ask your question on the air with us. Of course, course, you're always, if you would just like to give us a question and have it sent into the control room, we can do that as well if you don't want to go on the air, but we'd love to have you on the air if you would like to join us. So this is our first caller. This is Bill from Shreveport. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I had a question about the transmission of HIV through breast milk. I was unaware that that was a possibility. Can you tell me what the risk rate is for young mothers who are breastfeeding and if they're HIV positive? And are there any preventative measures that they can take in order to also breastfeed, which is, of course, good for the infant, but without transmitting the AIDS virus?
So to address the first part of that, or actually the last part of that, if a woman is on what they call antiretroviral therapy, or the cocktail, and her virus in the bloodstream is unmeasurable, it's below detectable levels, then it greatly decreases the chance via either unprotected sexual intercourse, breastfeeding, or blood exposure. Say somebody's drawn her blood, gets a needle stick. It greatly decreases the potential risk, but it's never put to zero. So although there are benefits of breastfeeding, for an HIV-positive woman who has a newborn who wants to breastfeed, it's never entirely safe, even on therapy. And because the virus is present in all bodily fluids, now whether it's blood, semen, vaginal secretions, breast milk, potentially there. Now, if she's not on HIV treatment or antiretroviral treatment, the risk might be somewhat similar to if she had a blood exposure or another person had exposure to her blood. It's something like 0.01. It's fairly low, and it's compared to the ease of transmitting, say, hepatitis viruses like hepatitis B, but it definitely happens. And although you can decrease the risk, breastfeeding would never be safe for that woman.
I wanted to ask you, since you have referred to it, and also Bobby earlier referred to the quote-unquote cocktail, exactly what these medications are. And as part of that, we do have an anonymous question from someone who has sent this in, and their question relates to that. Many of the current cocktails cause mild to severe gastrointestinal disorders. Are there any recommendations for diet or other treatments for these side effects? So if you could talk a little bit about what these drugs are, and if you could also address that question as well.
Well, first of all, in terms of the drugs, as was mentioned earlier, the first medicine, which was AZT, came out in 1987. There are several different categories aimed at different portions of the virus's life cycle inside the human body. And these drugs are typically used in triplicate, usually two members of one group and then a second or a third agent from one of two others. And it's expanded more recently as new targets have been developed. So there's about five or six total targets in the virus, and there's medicines that match at this point. And they're basically used in triplicate. And what was the second part of the question?
That the side effects that these drugs cause. Are there any recommendations, especially to offset the gastrointestinal disorders that come with them?
Now, in terms of, in this case, antiretrovirals, other antiviral medicines, antibiotics, antifungal medicines, there is nothing that's in these classes that has not potentially produced gastrointestinal side effects in the population, whether it's antibiotics, HIV medicines, antiviral medicines for treating the flu. Everything potentially can produce nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, loss of taste sensation, loss of appetite, sometimes constipation. It's kind of a core set of symptoms. In general, if gastrointestinal upset is severe, medicines can be used to treat, usually anti-nausea medicines, to treat that. But in the 2000s versus prior to 2000, the cocktail, the mixture of medicines, has in general been much better tolerated now than, say, from 1987 up through about 2000.
Mm-hmm.
fewer number of pills, better side effect profile in terms of the gastrointestinal side effects. In general, easier to take than when they first came out. And in particular, in 1996, which was kind of an extremely important year in HIV therapy, that's when the first member of the HIV medicine group called protease inhibitors was put on the market. At that time, this medicine called Zequinivir had multiple pills every day that you had to take, hands full of pills. But prior to the advent of this medicine and subsequent members of the group, HIV therapy was never very effective. It lasted a few months, maybe a year. Mm-hmm. You got sick and you died. 1996 forward, we could actually treat people chronically and keep them healthy. Initially, the side effects were bad, lots of pills, lots of throwing up, lots of diarrhea, but the medications were improved and the side effect profiles improved. Mm-hmm. So at this point, it is possible with several combination pills that are on the market, literally to take one pill a day and have minimal or no side effects.
We're discussing HIV and AIDS on tonight's edition of Health Matters. You can call in with your questions at 800-552-8502. Another anonymous question. If someone, and I know, Brett, that you alluded, of course, to the Philadelphia Center does do testing, but just in general, and maybe for people in other areas, if someone suspects that they may have contracted HIV, or for that matter, other diseases related to it, what should they do? What's the best way to go and get tested?
Well, the easiest way is, to start by calling us. Our number is 318-222-6633. And when you do get through to the front desk, ask for someone from the prevention department. The receptionist will then put you through to someone in our prevention department, and they can talk you through it on the phone. You can also email questions to us. You can do info@philadelphiacenter.org. And whatever questions come to us, we route them to the appropriate personnel who can respond to them. Those are kind of preliminary things that a person can do. The second thing is you can get online and look on a website, and you can get information about HIV and how the test is performed. But ultimately, it's coming on in, meeting with one of our counselors, and taking the test. Right now, we use the OraQuick test, which is a rapid oral HIV test, and you get the initial results within 20 minutes. So it's a very quick oral test that you can get, on your lunch break if you need to. So we try to remove all the barriers between people. So a lot of people, originally it was blood draw tests that had to be sent off to labs, and the results would take 2 weeks to get back at least. And then you would have to go back in and take a secondary confirmatory test, yada, yada, yada. Well, there's a little, to reduce anxiety, the test manufacturers have gotten really good over the years to where just the single oral swab test, 20 minutes later, you get your initial results. What we'll be starting in August, and this is new for us, but the tests that are provided to us, we do the oral test first, the oral swab test, and then typically what we have done in the past is do a second confirmatory oral swab test that we then sent off to a lab, and we would get the results back in about 4 business days. The contract that we have with the state, STD HIV program office now, starting in August, will include a rapid secondary or confirmatory test, which is a finger stick test called ClearView. So after the oral test, if it comes back as a preliminary positive, we can do the secondary or confirmatory test right there in our office now and get the results in less than 20 minutes at that point. So we don't have to send anything off to the lab anymore, and we can immediately link people up to medical care and social support
certainly is a sign that things have changed.
Definitely.
over the years.
Definitely.
We have a couple folks who are waiting online on the phones at the moment, so we'll go to the phones. This is Claire from Marksville, who I think has a question for Dr. Negron. Claire, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks so much.
Sure.
I'm so thankful for the antiretroviral drugs that have prolonged a lot of the lives of my patients for a really long time, and I've really had the opportunity to get to know these folks. But I had a question aimed actually to the physician, and you mentioned some of the retroviruses that spurred cancer or kind of initiated the whole cancer process. But I was also concerned about autoimmune diseases, and how do the viruses that cause cancer, would they have anything to do with autoimmune problems like lupus or psoriasis or some of the psoriatic arthritis conditions?
Now, if you heard earlier on in the show, I had mentioned that initially when HIV was diagnosed, they thought it may have arisen from cancer-causing viruses called HTLVs. And Bobby, who's on the panel here, actually mentioned HTLV-3, which is what they initially named what was eventually going to be designated HIV. HIV itself and it's the other retroviruses, which are called HTLVs, number one and number two, one of which causes a type of lymph gland cancer, have never been definitively linked to any autoimmune processes. Now, we know that HTLV-1 is associated with a type of lymphoma or lymph gland cancer. We know that HTLV-3, which was later changed in name to HIV, it's similar to HTLV, but it was really found to be distantly related. That's why they renamed it. HIV attacks parts of the white blood cells within the body and destroys them, and it causes basically failure of the human immune system so that you get sick, you get certain cancers and infections. But as far as I know, no actual connection to any of the rheumatologic illnesses like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, things like that.
All right, our next person holding online is Myron. Thank you so much for holding with your question. Go ahead. Thank you for calling Health Matters.
Thank you. This question is for Mr. Malone. With the state eliminating or drastically cutting prevention, have y'all seen a direct spike in new cases? And also, how are you kind of counteracting that as far as monies to raise money for prevention?
Actually, about 3 years ago, the General Administration started reducing state dollars that were allocated for HIV prevention to the point to where now there are actually zero state tax dollars that are allocated for HIV prevention. All of the funds that we currently utilize for that service are federal dollars, like the Ryan White Care Act, grants that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have awarded the state of Louisiana. So those are pass-through dollars where they go to the state and then the state redistributes those funds to different agencies via contracts to provide those services. What has happened is we have seen an increase in new HIV cases in our region and in our state to the point to where, for example, Baton Rouge is now number one in the U.S. for new HIV, or rather new AIDS diagnoses in the country. New Orleans and Baton Rouge both are usually fighting for number two, number one, or number three nationwide as cities with highest incident rates of HIV. So I think that there definitely is a direct correlation between lack of funding and support at the state level and an increase in HIV infections. What we have had to do, and thankfully we have a wonderful community that supports our mission and supports our cause, is turn to the local folks to support the work that we do. One of the things that we've done also is gone after more foundation grants, private donations, as well as soliciting help from volunteers in the community to help us to get the word out about HIV, about how it's transmitted and how to prevent its transmission. So it's almost like, in a way, we've gone back to the early 80s when there were no funds available and very little options for people, especially in rural communities. And technically, we're still considered a rural community in this region. So we just had to kind of go back to our grassroots origins and call upon the community to help us out so that we can really fulfill the mission that we have, which is to raise awareness about HIV and AIDS and to help to reduce the transmission of the virus.
So the funding question for me then, this is a situation that would seem to call for more funding, but the funding to do what specifically? Is it mostly a question of awareness with such a high incidence in the state of Louisiana? Is it that people don't have access to the information, that the information isn't being spread well enough, or are there other aspects to it?
It's probably a combination of things. One, there is a big digital divide in our society, especially more impoverished states and areas, and in Louisiana specifically, you know, access to information via the internet is a factor, you know, in terms of learning more about HIV, because a lot of what we do on Facebook, we do on our website, we do on other social media sites or social networking sites. I think one of the other challenges is that our educational system is set up to really not empower students with adequate or accurate information about their health. I mean, I remember growing up and we did have sex ed and it was kind of hidden away in our health and hygiene class. Now, we can't even use the word condoms if we are invited to go into a public school. And that's the only way that we can go into a school is by invitation by parents or by students. Even the teachers can't really invite us. Mm-hmm. So we are at a place now to where the abstinence-only sex education that is promoted both at the state level as well as local level is just grossly inadequate, and I think it's like an ostrich burying their head in the sand. You know, just say no is not enough when it comes to getting the truth out there about HIV or other STDs.
Sure.
And right now, again, the population that's growing the most are the young kids who are in school. So if we're not in the schools providing them accurate information or even access to the tools necessary to make good decisions about sexual behaviors or access to preventative things such as condoms, then we're not really teaching our kids.
Right.
They're not learning about it at home. They're not learning about it at church. The school's about the only other place, and we're not really welcome there unless a student or a parent invites us.
The number to call with your question this evening is 1-800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I'm Kermit Poling. My guests this evening on Health Matters are infectious disease physician Dr. Gerardo Negron. You've been listening to Brett Malone, the executive director of the Philadelphia Center in Shreveport, and along with Bobby Darrow, well-known in the arts community in the Northwest Louisiana, who has lived with HIV for 28 years. And Bobby, my next question actually comes back to you because a lot has changed over the years. We've alluded to that a few times. When you were first diagnosed, were there obstacles, or what were the obstacles to getting treated at the time?
Well, there was literally nothing. The doctors knew very little at that time. They were just starting to study and isolate this virus. There was no hope, really. And at that time, I was living in Shreveport, and I moved off to New York. I had a job offer up there in Manhattan, and I thought, oh, great, I'll at least be at the epicenter of research and knowledge about mm-hmm. This disease that was killing me. And so I jumped at the chance. I on my days off, a few days a week, I volunteered at the Community Research Initiative on AIDS in Manhattan, working under Dr. Joseph Sonnabend, one of the early pioneers. And I just read voraciously about HIV and AIDS and anything that could possibly keep me alive. And as the drugs came along, I went through many clinical trials developing those drugs. And it's a new day in the disease. It's still killing people. It's nothing that you want to have. But things are better.
Bobby, let me ask you on a personal level, because of course, you know, when you were first infected, that was a very early time in the history of the disease, and for a lot of people, they attached a stigma to it. How has that changed? What was it initially like, and has that improved?
Oh, gosh, yes. That was another reason for me moving off to New York, was I didn't want this, you know, secret to affect me or my family, especially my family, and because people were ostracized at that time in the mid-80s. People backed away from me. They wouldn't shake my hand. They would cover their mouth if they were close to me. And, you know, I understand those fears back in those days. But people have become more educated through the media, mainly. And I don't very often feel those feelings.
The call, the number to call this evening, 1-800-552-8502. We do have another caller who is waiting on hold. Thank you so much, Pete, for waiting from Zavala, Texas. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that I might have missed a few moments when I was walking back and forth. I'm trying to mow my lawn here. It's growing like crazy. that the blood supply is completely safe these days. Like 0.00001, and I just want people to realize that going to donate blood does not risk anybody for exposure to any hazardous diseases.
Sure, Dr. Negron mentioned that earlier. Thanks, Pete, for that question. But you might just remind them again about how that has changed.
Well, yeah. Well, again, prior to the late 80s, where screening of the blood supply actually started for a number of things. It used to be, like 30 and 40 years ago, it used to be a lot more commonplace to actually acquire illnesses through transfusions of blood products. You never get anything by donating. Post 1988, post 1990, where many pathogens, HIV, hepatitis viruses, many other things now, like West Nile virus, are screened for. It is extremely uncommon, not zero, you know, maybe 1 in 100,000, 1 in 1 million, but it's extremely uncommon to actually acquire an infectious disease through receiving blood products. But again, it's in the Western world. Very, very uncommon, extremely safe, especially compared to the 1980s. So, very safe thing.
And some people are, I think, sometimes still afraid to donate blood because of that. But if you're donating blood, there's really no danger.
No risk.
No, nothing at all. Other than a needle stick to obtain the blood, and a good phlebotomist will clean the area beforehand. Basically, no risk.
Let's talk a little bit about, of course, we know that the treatments are much improved and much more available than they were in the past, but let's talk a little bit about the cost. Is it still expensive to treat? What's the situation in general with insurance companies? If you could enlighten us a little on those situations, whichever one.
Well, on the topic of cost, if you typically are taking three medications, and we'll say separate pills, we'll forget mm-hmm. about combination pills.
Okay.
You might expect to pay $300 to $400 per medicine out of pocket for each medicine. So if you're taking three, that's about $1,000 every single month. And then multiply that by 12 months. And then if you have other illnesses, you add in cholesterol medicines. You can only take certain ones with HIV medicines, what they call opportunistic infection prophylaxis. If you've had any common opportunistic infections, depending on the status of your immune system, you could easily add in hundreds of dollars on top of the cost of the HIV medicines itself. Mm-hmm. Now, within the state of Louisiana, the private insurers, Blue Cross being the largest, United Healthcare, Humana, there's a variety of other private insurers. Most of them will cover the medicines to an extent. Most people do have what's called a deductible, typically due at the beginning of each calendar year, which is typically several hundred dollars, which means you have to pay your deductible each time January comes around, and then your coverage kicks in. So you could end up spending hundreds to maybe $1,000 each January to get your medicines. Mm-hmm. The Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries usually have access to some alternative programs to get coverage for the medicines. Medicaid itself will have a list of medicines, most of the HIV medicines, and then some of the auxiliary or opportunistic infection medicines. Most of those will be covered.
All right, the number to call if you have a question this evening, 800-552-8502, to call into Health Matters. If you'd like to remain anonymous or you just want to phone in your question, not necessarily on the air, that's fine as well. You can just let one of our staff know what your question is. But if you'd like to go online again, we welcome your call, 1-800-552-8502. And I do have one online question here from someone who has submitted, but as long as we were on the subject of cost and insurance, what about someone that can't afford the medications? Where do they turn?
Well, the Philadelphia Center has gotten really good about helping people get linked up with patient assistance programs. One such program is a federal program that's administered through the state of Louisiana called the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. That is one where finally, after a year and a half of that program being frozen, meaning they would not or could not, because of financial reasons, accept new patients, it's now open for enrollment again. And so the state is able to use the federal dollars that pass through to buy the HIV and opportunistic infections for people who are uninsured or don't have the financial resources to pay for the medications themselves. Usually that takes like a social worker or a caseworker to help navigate the system to be able to link up to all the different assistance programs that are out there. We do some limited patient assistance ourselves at the Philadelphia Center, and it's usually short term to get people through a crisis and then linked up either with the ADAP program or one of the pharmaceutical companies that offers patient assistance programs through their corporation.
Okay. This is a question from Jefferson, Texas. They didn't want to go on the air, and that's fine. This is a question from Jeremy, and this is for you, Brett. Historically, Louisiana has been notorious for long waiting lists to get on ADAP. And has this improved in the state of Louisiana? And you might explain what that is first.
The perfect timing, actually. ADAP, ADAP, it's the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. Again, it's a federal program that the monies are given to states to administer a state-level program, an ADAP program. Again, about a year and a half ago, the Louisiana ADAP program stopped and started developing an unmet needs list. Same thing as a waiting list, mm-hmm. but they called it an unmet needs list for some reason. And fortunately, at the federal level, the state of Louisiana was given an infusion of dollars just in the last year to try to eliminate that waiting list. And the people at the state level who administer this program in New Orleans did a really great job of going through their waiting list and getting people off of it as quickly as possible. One of the other options that is now available is what's called HIP, or the Health Insurance Program. This is great because the eligibility requirements are a little different. You don't have to be, at the federal poverty level or below, or like for our services, 200% of the federal poverty limit is typically the threshold for being eligible for services through the Philly Center. We do make exceptions in some cases depending on the situation. With ADAP, the threshold is higher, so people can still qualify for ADAP when they're earning more money. But the HIP program, the health insurance program, it's administered through an agency in Baton Rouge currently, but it goes up for bid. So different agencies every 2 or 3 years may be selected to administer that program. Mm-hmm. That program is great because it has, again, a higher threshold for eligibility. And the goal is to get people off of ADAP, so or other types of assistance programs, and switch to HIP, which is really about helping to helping people purchase private insurance plans and pay the premiums as well as the out-of-pocket expenses, the deductibles and the co-pays. This is great for people who may be eligible for group insurance through their employer. It may be good for people who have individual policies, but the premiums are so just out of reach that without that type of assistance, they couldn't make it. So there are options, and again, it's good to have somebody that can help you navigate these systems because sure. It's just really, it can be bureaucratic and confusing.
Well, I just wanted to chime in on that particular topic. You know, there is a change in the healthcare system, which is coming January 1st with the Federal Affordable Care Act, and the fact that pre-existing conditions, which basically is any illness that you have, HIV being a big one, cancer, you know, some of the bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
HIV positive individuals will no longer be able to be denied insurance because they are HIV positive.
Mm-hmm.
And what they call the healthcare exchanges, which will still exist in every state, whether it's administered by the state or run by the federal government, in conjunction with the state, those will go into effect, and that basically will open up private insurance at a more reasonable cost to many HIV-positive individuals. However, a number of our HIV-positive clients still would be not qualified for that. They would qualify for Medicaid, but this particular state, like many in the South, will not be expanding the Medicaid program come January 1st. So mm-hmm. We're actually still going to leave a fair number of HIV-positive individuals who should get coverage, they still will be without coverage.
Okay. We have Patrick, who has been waiting on hold with his question, and we'll just go ahead and take yours next. Thank you for calling 800-552-8502. Patrick, what's your question?
Hey, thanks for having me. This question goes to Brett. I just moved to the Shreveport area from Monroe, and I've got experience with smaller nonprofits in the resource development areas, primarily with fundraising, not grant. How could the local community or volunteers assist in generating funds for your agency?
Great timing, actually. The Philadelphia Center has a signature annual event that is the Auction Against AIDS. We are on April the 3rd, which is a week from this Saturday, at the Horseshoes River Dome. We'll be having our annual auction, which is our main fundraising event for the year. It's through this fundraising event that we were able to help to make up some of the differences in terms of lost funding through state or federal sources. Just to clarify, it's August 3rd, which is a week from this Saturday, and it will be at the Horseshoe River Dome. We're always looking for volunteers, for sponsors, for donors of items. So anyone could contact us either through the info@philadelphiacenter.org email address, or they can call us and speak with Angel at the front desk of the Philadelphia Center at 318-222-6633, extension 10, and can find out how they can help either as a volunteer, as a sponsor, or as a donor.
Okay, and the date of that event is, again?
It's August the 3rd.
August the 3rd.
Yes. Saturday.
Saturday,
coming up. 1-800-552-8502, the number to call if you have a question for tonight's Health Matters. We just have about 7 or 8 minutes to go for questions, but we can still probably get one or two more in. I did have one question for you that related to a couple of things that were said earlier. One, I think you alluded to that the largest part of the population that is showing an increase in HIV are the young people. Did I catch that correctly?
Currently, yes, that's the case. Interestingly enough, it used to be considered almost exclusively a gay white man's disease in the United States in the early years. Over the last 30 years, we've seen a transition in this epidemic, you know, demographically, to where it's impacting younger people in the African American community and women at a very disproportionate rate compared to what the population is. For example, just in the last year, I mean, we look at Louisiana, where African Americans make up 33% of the state's population, but comprise 74% of all the new HIV cases. Mm. So there's definitely a disconnect between what would be expected across the board for all the different, you know, racial and ethnic groups. One of the other differences, too, is we've seen quite a bit of increase with women contracting HIV. And in fact, here locally, like at the Philadelphia Center, 32% of the people that we serve are women. It's rare now that we see children being born with HIV as it used to be, and that's because of early intervention, medical treatment with women who are pregnant, as well as newborns. So that the transmission rate there has dropped down to, you know, less than 1%, mm-hmm. if it's actually if the mother is actually treated prior to birth. So yes, we have again about 70%, roughly 2/3 men and 1/3 women currently.
And let me just ask you, and we do have another person waiting on the phone here, and we'll get right to you, Pierre. Hang on there. The number of people that are infected versus the number of people that are actually treated, what is the ratio, and what does that mean for future infections?
Dr. Negron could probably comment a little bit more about like the treatment cascade, which is something that came about through the National HIV/AIDS strategy that the Obama administration developed in 2010. And it's quite interesting in terms of looking at the different stages of the virus in the population. So those who are tested and know that they're positive compared to those that we can predict are positive but don't yet know it. It's ranges anywhere from 20% to 30% above what our current infection rate is. So if we have, say, example, 1,000 people infected in a local community, we would expect maybe 1,200 to 1,400 people to actually be infected. But the 200 to 400 people who are infected don't know it.
Okay. Let me go to Pierre now, who's been waiting very patiently for a chance to offer his question. Pierre, go ahead with your question.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
In 1981, I was diagnosed as a positive. And I decided at that time that I didn't want nothing to do with treatment. I'd seen how miserable the end is. And I decided to just live my life while as long as I felt good. And when I don't feel any more good of it, take care of myself. Well, I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and nothing ever happened. Did I get a wrong test, or am I immune?
Dr. Negron, that sounds like a question for you.
Now, the only way to tell if the test was wrong is to repeat the HIV testing. There is a very rare but very well characterized group or cohort of people who are HIV positive who don't progress. Long-term non-progressors, they remain positive, virus is detectable, but they have a particular mutation on their cells which prevents the virus from really spreading unchecked as it most often does. So again, the only way to tell if that was an error 3 decades ago is to go and get retested for HIV. If it were negative now, and do remember the testing, really until about the mid-80s, testing didn't exist. There was surrogate markers that you got sick and they inferred that you had an AIDS-defining illness, which was a definition we applied later. But it would have taken several years into the decade of the 80s to actually get an HIV test because it didn't exist for several years. So if you were tested now, tested negative, then that would mean there was a misdiagnosis some three decades ago.
All right. We have what I think is probably going to be our last question for the evening. This one was sent in via email. I am an HIV positive patient. Typically, we're tested for viral loads and CD4 count every 4 months. Recently, my physician has been looking at viral load levels. Is it important to have both of these regularly? And what is the importance of these tests? And in between these tests, are there any signs that HIV has progressed to AIDS? So I guess a complex question for a short amount of time.
Well, on the topic of CD4 counts, which are the host, the person's white blood cells called CD4 lymphocytes, and virus load, which reflects how much HIV is measurable in a certain aliquot of a person's blood. Those two things are basically the only direct laboratory parameters to measure is your treatment working or not. An ideal response is if your CD4 counts are low and you are starting to get sick as a consequence of that, taking therapy should regrow the cells so your CD4 count rises. Concurrently, the virus load should become very, very low, preferably undetectable, which by current standard current standards is less than 20 HIV particles per one microliter of blood. Now, in between visiting your provider and having these tests performed, the only way to tell if you are actually progressing is if you come down, if you are not in the AIDS category yet, and there are about 24 things that put you in that category. If you're not there yet and you should develop an AIDS-defining illness, certain infections, certain cancers, and a few other things, then that would indicate, yes, you have progressed. It also likely means the treatment is not working.
We're coming very close to the end of our program tonight. So, gentlemen, I want to thank the three of you for being here and for answering the questions and discussing this topic. Clearly, something that we need to revisit again on a future Health Matters. Bobby, I was going to ask you, if you wouldn't mind, before we leave tonight, since you are someone that has lived with HIV for so long, any advice, words of optimism for those who suspect that they may be infected and what they should do?
Well, definitely consult with a physician, but a little bit of hope. For over a decade, I lived with between 3 and 7 T cells, or CD4 cells, mm-hmm. and that's just at the bottom of the barrel. And today, my last test was in the 350 range, and undetectable viral load, when that had been in the hundreds of thousands. So there is hope with good medical care, but that's the key.
All right, that's Bobby Darrow. Of course, many of you know, artistic director of Shreveport Little Theater, and glad to have you on this evening. I was also joined by infectious disease physician Dr. Gerardo Negron and Brett Malone, the executive director of the Philadelphia Center in Shreveport. And before we go, why don't you mention one more time about the fundraiser that you have coming up?
Oh, thanks. Yes, it's A Midnight Summer's Dream, which is our 24th auction against AIDS, and it's going to be Saturday, August the 3rd at the Horseshoes River Dome. It starts at 5 p.m. for the cocktail hour, and the auction doors open in the River Dome at 6 p.m. so people can come in and have some great food, dance, listen to some great music, good entertainment, and have a good time raising money for a good cause.
All right, and good luck to you with the fundraiser, and thank you again, all three of you, for being as part of this program. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance from Henry Edwards and Jeff Bryant. Funding for Health Matters comes in part from the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation. This show will be available as a podcast on our our website at redriverradio.org. A resource list will be available later in the month. I'm your host, Kermit Poling. Thank you for joining us this evening. This is member-supported Red River Radio, a public radio service of LSUS. You're tuned to KDAQ, Shreveport, Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, Magnolia, and KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches.